Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. All right, welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
This is Adam Barrett.
Hey, Adam. You know, last episode we left with a promise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and luckily we only made the promise in real time about 30 seconds ago.
So easy to follow through.
Easy to follow through with that.
Yeah.
So in the meantime, I'm quite sure we got a bunch of comments and feedback and questions. And I suspect in the next 20 minutes or so, we'll probably lay out some structure and how to do this kind of stuff, how to get the environment defined. How do you characterize it? Yet we already know that there's so many different products and constraints out there. We're not going to catch them all. So what do you think we give it a college try?
Or we said, but the other thing we said too was, how do you justify it, right? So it's anybody who's on the side of having to justify a reliability statement or to try to make something reliable, it's not a hard sell to them, right? Mm-hmm. They would love to be able to go out in the field for a month and, you know, study something. So the first big hurdle, right, is helping justify that expense to the greater organization. So that's, I think, the first thing we promised to talk about.
Okay. Well, let's do that. Before we dive into it, let's make a little break here.
Kirk Gray here. We want you to know that my company, Accelerated Reliability Solutions, is ready to support you with experienced leadership, guidance, and training to rapidly develop reliable, robust, and mature electronics at market introduction. To get started, go to accendoreliability.com/go/accelerated.
All right. So we made two promises here, besides whatever was aired during that break. Is how do you justify the investment in doing an environmental characterization? Yeah. And then second, how do you do it?
Right. So,
and they're tied together, right? You could just wing it. You can say, oh, nobody will use it that way. And it takes 30 seconds and you're done. It's not terribly valuable though.
No. Now, the value is abstract initially because, you know, we were talking about the Toyota Sienna minivan. I was saying, you know, how you've owned one. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading just how much they invested in, you know, field study, you know, where an engineer came over and just rented minivans in North America, you know, being a very different market. They use them pretty differently than in Japan, you know, and studied it. So how did he justify that budget, very large budget? And I think, unfortunately, the times I've seen where programs really lay out a specific budget and one that is sufficient for it is when they've experienced the pain that they can very clearly correlate to having not done it before, because there's an exact dollar value, right? If you had a product launch that failed, you can measure how much it failed by your expectations. And you see that dollar value.
Or drop in market share, or you're getting blocked out of a product line in your portfolio, or there's way to, and it's not just doing environmental studies. It's anytime you get a big disaster, that seems to be a rallying call to go fix something. It's harder to justify proactively saying, hey, if we spend $100,000, it'll save us $1 million. It's hard. And that's not just for environmental studies. It's all kinds of stuff we deal with. The hard part I find, and I think ties into what you're going after with how do you justify it, is that the design team from characterization on is going to make thousands of assumptions and thousands of decisions that having a better, more intimate knowledge of the environment and how people use the product, they would be much more likely to make the right decisions more often. Is that a way to go about doing this justification without having the luxury of a recent disaster?
I think it's pretty simple. The right decision, they're making a better decision because they have more information going into it. It's a big difference between sitting in a conference room and generating information and having actually studied it. So,
I can see this going on at some tool shop, right, where they're designing a new tool and they invite you into a design review with them. And they're saying, oh, this is used for this much torque and you get this much handle on it. And right. the average use of a person's strength is this and that.
Yeah.
And you're over there cleaning the bottom of your shoe off with it.
Right, right. You know? I'm like, actually, I can get way more torque when I put a pipe on the end of it and I have an extra 3 feet of leverage.
That's right.
Like, oh, no. Yeah. And I'm like, well, look, when I need to get, you know, when that thing is stuck, I'm getting it off, you know. So, right. Okay. So there's the work. So, you know, you invite in people and you go and study. So what, you know, that's, and then you have to try to correlate what you could miss market wise if you don't. Now, what about in the program where you do it? Because it's not just the, you know, we're talking a little bit about the market and the end customer. What about internally amongst the teams? Because I see even within the engineer organization, a tremendous mismatch of understanding of use case and environment. And the way that this ends up having a big impact is if you are developing test protocols, you are going to create stresses, and they're some in some way connected to use case stresses mm-hmm. and environment. And then you're making statements based on the testing results. Well, if these use cases aren't and environments are not very clearly defined, the people who are making decisions based on those results or interpreting those results, if they have a different definition of it, you know, they can be making decisions that may not reflect their what they actually would do if they understood the match between use case and those results. So it doesn't even not even just outside the company.
Well, yeah, I agree. Inside the company, as you where I see it is the most value, the place to do it. And it starts before you even really know what the product's going to look like, before you've created a first prototype, is in the part of the early on decisions in product development, many product life cycles, is there a market for this? Who are we going to sell this to? How many are there? You know, kinds of questions. If we make a product for only one person, we can, it's a different price point than if we make it for 3 million people, potential customers. At that point, start defining the customers. And that's one of the major roles of marketing groups and marketing teams and so on, is whoever is in defining who you're going to sell it to, is that the reliability sets of questions are, well, where are these people? Where mm-hmm. do you expect them to use it? How many times? And then we used to call it an environmental manual, and it was part of the product requirements documents. So it was, we expect to have these five different categories of people using these printers, these home printers. Some will use it at office that uses it 24/7, 5 days a week, you know, and just prints full color. Like the archetype was a broker of a real estate broker printing flyers for their listings. Heavy user, heavy color, stiff paper, you know, just beating the daylights out of this printer. Not a, like a hammer, but.
Yep.
You know, versus another, and there was a small fraction of the overall population in that environment. And then on the other end was the very occasional home use, the kids print their homework, you know, or do a computer project once a quarter. And in that document, it didn't say how we're going to test it. It didn't say anything. It just said, here's the different groups of temperatures, humidities, vibrations, frequency of use, stresses it would see for different types of customers in our target market. And that then set up the definition for design teams to say, oh, we need to use metal, not plastic. We need to do this versus that. All before we start testing. Then we start looking at, well, where is it going to fail or not fail? Well, the types of testing we did for people that rarely used it was concerned with dust buildup and, mm-hmm. you know, mechanisms getting clogged with old oil and not being lubricated correctly, and all these other things. Where the heavy use was, how often can the ink cartridge be replaced? Because they're probably replacing it every week. And so completely different mechanisms that we were evaluating for different use cases. And then it gets complicated, whereas you got to make decisions and trade-offs. It's only one product.
Is there a mechanism in your program to when these decisions happen or that gets driven? So my
concern it was in the product life cycle. It was, you know, it was, you had to have the basic definition right up front.
But the thing is that my concern is that I see so often that that step can, when you're looking to squeeze a program time-wise, which you always are, mm-hmm. I see that being something that gets squeezed from being a study to a discussion in a meeting. kind of what you're saying, yeah. Where originally you were going to study all those users. I mean, like, I never worked in the printer industry, but I know that there was a bit of a, you know, a significant jump in a market when they realized that when the prices came down to the point a lot of college students would have them in their room, mm-hmm. you know, that was a new use case study because you had 3 months in the summer where they wouldn't get used, right? So that's
also packed in with books and no right. space. And exactly. So they would be exactly. crammed into everything else.
Very different. Very different. So how do you go from choosing to study what's happening in the field and a mechanism and taking the time, because that's not the thing. It's not just the money. It's the time. Those studies take time.
Well, it's part
how do you see them getting compressed?
Well, it will get compressed, yet it's not just this product. We want to sell to college students this year, next year, the year after, and so on. So it's an ongoing process. At first it's saying, oh, hey, if we get it to $300, we can sell it to dorm rooms. But what's different about a dorm room versus what we already know? And so it might only be a meeting one afternoon with a handful of people. And then we have questions. So marketing guys or sales guys, go get this information so we can make better decisions. Target it. You know, you don't need to do a full year study characterization of it. Is go answer a few questions. And then it's an iterative process. It always is then. If that market develops and it becomes huge, well, what's the range of temperatures that dorm rooms see in the summer? You know, Fargo, North Dakota is very different than Denver, Colorado, or Miami. Mm. And does Miami keep them air conditioned or not? You know,
right?
It all matters. Right. So the more refined you get depends on, does that market develop? Does it become real? Do you need to actually need more? Part of the early part, though, is are we selling this printer to home users, to indoor-outdoor users, to fishing boats, to dorm rooms? Let's narrow down what we're designing for. And then it's get you involved to break it a bunch of different ways because you take it out on your deep-sea fishing boat and use it as a hammer.
Right, right. Exactly.
Right? Exactly. But it's –
I like that I'm your favorite case study for anything.
Oh, now it is, yeah. But I think to get started with the process is – you have to make decisions about where you're going to use the product. So whether it's a quick meeting or whatever, document it. And then the step that I see that's missing is people care about where the product is used because that's used in so many ways, is document it. Write it down. It's 2 pages to start with.
There you go. Right and there. Then write it down.
Write
that's
it down.
That's the thing.
Yeah. And make it available and then leave a place where you could say, we need more information on
exactly,
and
then you need the mechanisms, the triggers in the program that highlight that it's missing.
Yeah,
at the different stages, because it's something easy to have be not acknowledged as missing because everybody has their assumption.
Right.
Right. So, you know, everybody assumes how the product's going to be used. So without something that really triggers the, hey, let's synchronize and see if we're all thinking the same thing here. And mm-hmm. And by everybody, are we thinking the same thing the marketing guys are thinking, that the test engineers are thinking, that are, you know,
yeah.
So that's it. But it's having that mechanism because everybody assumes that, you know, their own version of it, and they assume everybody else is thinking the same thing.
Yeah. And it's not the test requirements. That's completely separate in my mind. It's write down what your population of customers are going to use. And it may make sense to characterize that, you know, light users, heavy users, or home users, office users, or indoor versus outdoor, whatever proportion of those customers use it in those different areas. Write down the weather. What's the product going to see in the weather? And there's tons of ways to get that data from National Ocean and Atmospheric Agency, NOAA, whatever they're called. They got gazillion weather stations and you can have access to gathering all that data. So if you're going to only sell it in Boston, you can get the last 20 years of weather data by the hour and yep. have more data than you care for. The hard part I think there's 2 mistakes. One is we think everybody lives and works and uses our product like we do. That's a bad assumption, and I think that's pretty obvious. The other part is that it's not a 10 degrees. What would be the high and low for your area, Adam, in a typical year? What would be the typical high temperature you would see and the typical low temperature you would see?
I mean, you could have probably, you know, the coldest day of the year typically could be, you know, this is a Fahrenheit, you know, would be, let's say, -5 or something. So we're talking about, you know, talking about 35 degrees beneath freezing. Typical, like, hot, you know, you couldn't 95 Fahrenheit or something. Or, you know, we've had summers that are higher. So, you know, if you get the real extremes, they start to match some of the, you know, the general extremes of the U.S. But it's a pretty big, it's pretty variable.
It's very variable. But it's also what I find is if you just write down the extremes, I'm going to use this product outdoors. It needs to survive at -5 to 95 degrees Fahrenheit and work in those conditions. The first designer that runs into a problem with those conditions is going to say, but that's 1 hour, one day a year with one customer. I'm not designing for that. So I'm designing for 22 degrees, you know, or Celsius, 70 degrees Fahrenheit. That's it.
That could be totally the right thing to do, too. That could be the correct response, that our cost point is more important than that, you know, small percentage. But again, it's a conscious decision based on real data and real decisions. And
we've got,
more importantly, when he makes that decision. But more importantly, when he makes that decision, though, it gets updated in documentation. And now everybody else is working with that new use case and environment and not the older one. You know, that's the big deal for me.
So weather data, we have the data. We can make histograms and we can decide we want to be at the 90th percentile, the 50th percentile, whatever. We pick the range we want to be in and we know what it is. Where, how often does somebody use it? A lot of times that's just back of the envelope. And again, though, it's saying, all right, somebody's going to put it on and off 3 times a day and they're going to plug it in overnight every day. And that's just a straight guess.
Yeah.
You know, unless you start measuring it. And but write it down and say, well, what if somebody only uses it once a month? And what if somebody uses it, you know, on and off 20 times a day? How does that change our assumptions? And what, and it becomes a gray area is, well, what range are we going to design for?
Right.
And so it's, but writing it down, making it clear, categorizing those things, and which ones do we need more information? If it's something that's a wearable device, well, how often does somebody put it on or off? Well, that might be worth the investment to go get, you know, 30 prototypes and give them to your employees and say, hey, go play with it.
Yeah.
And just track it, measure it, get some data. And more would be with studies and, you know, observations and similar products and all that other stuff. But start with what you can as guess. Understand where you need more data, where it's going to make a difference in your design decisions, and then go get that data that you need. You don't need to characterize everything. Characterize the ones that are going to impact your decisions. That's where I come down on this process. And I think you and I both agree is write it down.
Yeah. And update it and update it, because like you said, it's very often an engineer will be like, once they find out what the cost is associated to the original specifications, they're like, now we can't meet our cost point. So we're going to adjust it, the temperature range, and that's acceptable. But, you know, does everybody else know you just did that?
I just want to throw stuff through the wall when I hear, we can't, it costs too much to work at 55 degrees Celsius. So we're going to adjust it down to 40 degrees C, and we'll put it in the manual that they can't operate it above 40 degrees C. You know,
right.
Yeah. All right. Who's going to read the manual? This is internal to the computer, and you're saying you can't get it above 40 degrees C. I don't even have a way to measure that or track it. You know, it's just going to happen. Yeah. And then you ask them, so what's your exhaust on the fan coming out? Oh, it's at 85 degrees C. All right, and you're going to say customers can't use it above 40. Now, how does this work, guys?
Yeah, exactly.
This was a real story, by the way.
Oh, I believe it. I believe it. I think at that point you're dealing with some other stuff too, some denial and planning on, you know, not caring about, you know. Anyway, that's a whole different thing.
Yeah.
So,
but anyway, the idea is to fully characterize it. It sensors these days are so cheap. You know, get prototype. You can do a lot just on what's online and what's available through databases, especially weather type stuff. How people use it, well, make prototypes and give it to people and watch them use it is the simplest by far, I think. A lot of back of the envelope stuff, though, a lot of just guessing and trying to understand how your market uses a bit, but don't let just the engineers do it. I'd say get those marketing folks involved and people with the concept for this product involved. Then it becomes more of a science, is measuring and sensors and observations and characterization work. Because I like doing this kind of stuff because it often turns into a halt test. I was working with a handheld device once, and we wanted to find out how hard somebody could throw it into a wall. One of the decisions was, do we put a wrist strap on it or not? Mm-hmm. And there's risks on both sides. If somebody falls and the wrist strap breaks the wrist, then it's a problem. But mm-hmm. if they, much more likely that they swing their hand playing this game and they lose their grip and it goes through the TV or it goes mm-hmm. through, hits somebody else. But what we didn't know was how much force something thrown into a wall 3 feet away would actually generate. So we came up with these sensor plates and everything else, and we had a baseball pitcher come in and throw stuff at it, which is an amazingly how fast they can throw something, into a bunch of just normal gamers, to random people in the office. And we got 30 different people to throw it as hard as they could into this wall and censored it up, and we got a distribution. And then we went back to the design team saying, here's where we think most people doing this would happen. Here's where the extreme is. And it wasn't a cost difference to making it survive for everybody. So they did. Mm-hmm. Now it's just a weapon. You can throw it really hard.
Right.
It will break your TV if you throw this thing.
Yeah. And then
they gathered other information as well. How strong does the wrist strap need to be? And what's the breakoff point that if the strap comes loose before it breaks, has enough force to break your wrist, then it was a trade-off, right? Mm-hmm. And it had cost, but it went back and forth. But it was a lot of fun finding out where those margins were and mm-hmm. how people actually do stuff with things. And some things are tabulated and calculated and available. Other things, you just got to go get creative and measure it. I actually measured the butt bone pressure on a couch to break a device.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, that definitely is something. The Apple just got caught on that, right? When they came out with the iPhone 7.
Was like 7 the bendy phone? Bending.
Yeah. I was really surprised that they hadn't better characterized that. That's kind of, to me, a very fundamental part of their use case is it spends most of its time in somebody's pocket, you know?
Well, yeah, or dropping it. It was a Dilbert cartoon recently was about making a beautiful, slippery, fragile device. And that was their market, definition. They were trying to design so that 100% of them failed within 3 minutes of the person picking it up.
right, exactly.
Yeah, not really a good design, guys. You know, it's pretty, but yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, so what are we, so I think that what we're telling people is that to be conscious of it, to document it, communicate it, keep it updated, and make sure it's connected with everything else, you know, as you're saying,
make it connected to a decision. Make it connected.
Yeah.
Like if I need to decide, do I put a lanyard on it or not? What information do you need to know mm-hmm. to make that decision? And that's, then go characterize that. It's very much a good summary there, Adam. So I'm sure we missed a bunch of stuff. You know, we should come back and talk about the different ways of measuring things because there are so many neat tools out there and ways to be creative about measuring the stresses and forces being put on products and temperatures and humidities and everything else.
And clearly, I'm odd enough to ask for people's report summaries for Christmas presents. I don't remember if that was the last episode or this one where I confessed that I asked for the program engineering notes.
But
that included the testing results summaries from a car from 40 years ago.
Well, you got to put that in the show notes. You put that out, and maybe see others can find it for their next year's, for their birthdays or whatever.
This car has a cult following. So, if you can imagine, if a book like that's been written where they're interviewing the engineers that did it,
that's cool. So. That is cool. And it's old enough that, it's not going to really affect the trade today, the designs today. But the process sounds like it would be worth replicating.
Yeah, I mean, things like that, like intent and, you know, I mean, it's when something has that much success, they clearly, you know, structured a program that, you know, correctly assessed and addressed the things that were necessary. Mm-hmm. And that's timeless.
Yeah. Now, sounds good. So if we've sparked any thoughts or if you have some good stories as a listener to the show, if you've done some of this stuff, either good or bad, where you should have looked at the environment more closely or you were surprised by how Adam used your product, you know, let us know. Head over to reliability.fm and leave us a comment or a suggestion. We'd love to hear from you. And it's a big part of making a product is making sure it works where it needs to work. And I think that's the gist of this episode and the previous one. So appreciate everybody listening, and we look forward to hearing from you. Thanks so much.
Take care, everyone.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.